Well, our next Pop-Up Stories event is nearing. I'll remind you of the basics here right now. The theme for storytellers, the heat is on. It is 1 week from Wednesday. We hope you can join us at Red Cedar Spirits, Merritt Road, East Lansing, for storytelling on that theme. We're still looking for storytellers, as it turns out. More information on our Facebook page, Pop-Up Stories Lansing. We mark 1 year of first-person true storytelling events with this upcoming event at Red Cedar Spirits. So we're excited about that. The interest in this has just grown and grown, and we are grateful for your interest for that. So plan to join us, please, on the 31st if you can. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. Last week, we heard on this program from two Meridian Township critics of a planned bus rapid transit system running between Lansing and Okemos. Lansing's Capital Area Transportation Authority, CATA, has a shot at more than $130 million in federal and state money earmarked for just such a system. It would create dedicated bus lanes and significantly alter intersections and traffic patterns. Supporters, including our next three guests, say the BRT would allow faster, safer travel down Michigan and Grand River Avenues and be a boost to the local economy. But critics, particularly in Meridian Township, have ongoing problems with the design, costs, and suitability of the project, and they complain that CAT is not responding to their concerns. We will hear the views of three BRT supporters here this morning. Bob Swanson is the vice chair of the CATA Board of Directors. Bob, welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Sean Hammond is the founder of the grassroots organization CATS, Capital Area Transit Supporters. He's also deputy policy director at the Lansing-based Michigan Environmental Council. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you, Mark.
And Joe Ross is an East Lansing business owner who supports the BRT. Joe Ross, welcome.
Glad to be here.
We'll get into the broader reasons that you support the BRT, but first let's address resistance here that's coming out of Meridian Township. Last week, we had two opponents from Meridian here on Current State, one of them a township official, Clerk Brett Dreyfus, and he claims that CATA continues not to provide answers to the questions and concerns of some number of Meridian Township residents. After attending a public meeting with CATA last week, he said he was extremely disappointed. Here is why.
The main problem was that CATA knew many of the top questions that have been asked repeatedly, key issues about the potential benefits of having a center running a BRT, about problems with no left turn, about the impact on businesses, about the impact that it might have on people with disabilities to have to cross Grand River, many, many issues. And none of those were actually addressed. We spent the majority of the meeting was spent trying to get people to vent their questions in the audience. There was an hour and a half available for the meeting, and an hour and 15 minutes was spent going around the audience and repeating questions that have been asked for 6 months.
So, Bob Swanson, I'll direct my first question here to you. Some number of township residents clearly don't feel their questions have been answered by CATA. From your perspective, what's going on here?
Well, I think you have to understand this has been a long process in terms of the development of the BRT. CATA started looking at it internally 7 years ago. The last 3 years, there's been a large number of opportunities for public input, a whole series of charrettes, public meetings. And yet in a big project like this, in a complex project, people don't always notice what's happening. And I think as the project gets closer and closer, and we still have a ways to go, we're only 30% designed, but as the project gets closer and closer, people suddenly realize or become aware of the project, and maybe they missed those opportunities for input. A lot of people didn't come, and they're feeling maybe they're a little bit behind in terms of what's happening and how it's going. We have had at a lot of different meetings the opportunity to address some of those specific concerns. What we were trying to do in the meetings last week, the two that we had in Meridian Township, was to get out on the table the questions and concerns that people had Everybody who attended those meetings is going to get written responses to those questions that were laid out last week. So they'll have them right in front of them. That'll be happening very soon.
Was it CATA's intention to answer the questions at that time, or was the plan all along to get back to them later?
I think that it depended on how the meeting went. We had a lot of people turn out. There were lots of questions to get out on the table.
Gotcha.
We did get into some discussion, and we did have some of our consultants there, the traffic engineering specialists who really understand and has helped design the project to this point. But there were a lot of people there who wanted to get their questions out on the table, and so we'll get back with everybody and written responses to them.
Well, we'll return in a minute to a few specific sticking points for these critics in Meridian Township, but I do want to give you a couple of you a chance here to go back to square one, I guess, if you will, and make the case for this more broadly. Sean Hammond, what makes Lansing and East Lansing and Meridian Township right for a BRT line?
Well, Mark, the big thing is we're already at capacity on the number one line that serves that main corridor. As we're seeing this grow, we're seeing more and more development along Michigan Avenue corridor. You can see high rises going up every day now, especially that new one in Frandor went up real quick. But we're already seeing max capacity on a lot of these one buses, leaving people at bus stops, which threatens jobs and getting people there who don't have any other form of transportation. And really, you can't just add another bus to this route at this point. We're already at every 10 minutes or so, cutting it down to every 6 or 7 minutes would completely make traffic a nightmare.
You'll also hear people say, though, that it's also, and this a lot of this is anecdotal, but it's not that hard to hear people say, hey, I see a CATA bus go by and it's half full or it's mostly empty or things like that. Joe Ross, any thoughts on that? I mean, you've got a business on Route 1,
yeah,
correct?
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because it's a misnomer. I mean, we have seven people that, most mornings are making their way to our little company in East Lansing, and they a lot of them use that corridor going down Grand River to Michigan Avenue. And they all tell me about the fact that it's a little ridiculous now. And every year it gets a little worse. They have to leave like 45 minutes early because during peak times in the morning, that's when those buses are full. And during peak times in the evening, that's when they're full. So, you know, if you look at them at noon or you look at them at 2 o'clock, no, you'll see some buses that are half empty.
Bob Swanson, let's come back to you. I was not at either of the public meetings last week, but I've spoken to several people who were. One of the biggest concerns among skeptics right now, I know, is how emergency vehicles are going to make turns. A lot of this is about turns and U-turns. Apparently, emergency vehicles in particular need a lot of room. What do you know about that? Is the design right now, does it not accommodate U-turns for emergency vehicles?
That's an issue that we're constantly working on. We've had meetings with emergency responders, and we will continue to do that. It's been done in other communities, so we know that it's possible to do. There are techniques for doing it. There are medians that are built specifically to allow emergency vehicles like ladder trucks and such to cross right over the median. And we haven't fixed a solution to this. As I said, we're 30% designed. We've got a ways to go. That's one of the issues we'll continue to work with the emergency responders about. But it's certainly an issue that's ongoing, and it's one that has been across the country and will be, in this case, designed into the project.
It is true, though. Well, confirm or deny this for me, Bob. Isn't it true that township fire officials and designers agreed that the design, at least at one time, if not right now, the design did not allow emergency vehicles enough room? There was consensus on that at one time, wasn't there?
I really don't know the answer to that question.
Okay.
I know there have been ongoing dialogue about it. It's hard to say the design didn't allow for it because the design is something that's an evolving thing.
And that's one of your main...
So the concept is, okay, we need to be able to make those left turns and to cross the median or make the U-turns. And how do we make that work? That's where we are in the process right now.
And this is one of the proponents' major messages, if I understand this correctly, and that is that the design is 30% done, you say, and apparently 70% yet to be designed. You say there's time in the process to accommodate the design changes that need to be made. Are you all agreed on that?
Well, absolutely. There's time. This is part of the whole process of engaging people. It's ironic, Mark, that we hear two things often from opponents. One is that the project keeps changing, and it's a moving target. It's not a specific project.
It's to accommodate the changes the critics want.
We've got lots of changes we want to get in. Well, the reason it has evolved. It's now $26 million cheaper than under estimates than it was when we first started because we have that 30% design done. We know a lot more. We're going to obviously know more the more that gets designed. But the project has changed because we've listened to input. We've done the studies. We've had the traffic engineers do the traffic studies and analyses. And it's changed. And it can and will change as we go forward with the rest of the design phase. And that's one of the things we've said to people in Meridian Township and elsewhere. We had a meeting last Friday with the disability community to talk about issues. As people have issues and concerns, and there are still problems to be addressed, we're working on solutions to that, and we want to hear from people about it.
Bob Swanson is vice chair of the CATA Board of Directors. We're also joined by Sean Hammond, founder of the grassroots organization CATS, Capital Area Transit Supporters. Joe Ross is an East Lansing business owner who supports the BRT, the Bus Rapid Transit Plan, that is taking shape for Route 1, put together by CATA between Lansing and Okemos. Let's deal with the concerns of the disabled community, and I'll direct this to whomever is most qualified to address this. There have been concerns about people with disabilities getting to the buses themselves, because the buses will be going down the middle of Grand River or Michigan Avenue. Are those concerns justified?
Well, you know, right now we see some issues on that corridor, especially in Meridian Township as it is. You see there's not really any place to cross between Hagedorn and Okemos Road. There's very limited ability to even cross the road. So you end up with people who can't cross the road safely, riding the bus all the way down to one end and turning around and coming back. Putting it in the median with signalized crossings that are advanced crossings at this point going in, and they'd be some of the latest and greatest technology for safe crossings. And you would have that ability to safely cross with a button across the median and board the bus without having to step up on the bus, without the bus having to kneel. It's the level boarding platforms. So ultimately, this is going to be much more accessible without having to worry about crossing the really dangerous corridor between Hagedorn and Okemos Road, where there are really no opportunities to cross that five-lane road.
I know some of your harshest critics are saying that the plan, at least as it currently exists or did exist at one time, doesn't comply with the Americans for Disability Act. Would you take issue with that, Bob?
Yeah, I would take issue with that. The planning for this, and it's, as I said, still ongoing, is to absolutely comply with all the provisions of the ADA. One of the things, and Sean just mentioned it, allowing the crossing of Grand River only at signalized crossings is a great improvement in terms of safety. And there are ways working under the ADA and with the disability community to make that crossing even safer. Tactile use of the crosswalk so you can feel where it is. Speakers that tell you when you can cross and how much time you have left to cross. They have some of those in East Lansing right now, but those are vast improvements in terms of being able to help someone with a disability get across the street. And with the center running, you have a station in the center, so you're crossing half of Grand River, not trying to get across the whole stretch at one time.
I know Joe Ross is an East Lansing business owner here. I know Michigan State has apparently expressed concerns about BRT safety. The East Lansing News website, ELI, reports that Michigan State's concerned about a reduction in the number of places where pedestrians could cross Michigan in Grand River. What's your experience as an East Lansing? Do you have any relevant experience here as an East Lansing business owner with disabled people being able to access your business?
Well, the way the bus system is right now, I mean, I hear about little accidents, little fender benders all the time, because when you have that many buses going, the way in the current situation that are trying to pull over and get back into traffic and merge three lanes over in East Lansing, that's a real problem. You put them down the center, and I think it's going to take that issue away. I'd encourage anybody, if you're wondering that the BRT is a good idea or a bad idea, simply Google it. That's why I came forward as just a resident supporting this thing. I mean, I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm no big fan of throwing away government, you know, spending taxpayer money. But boy, you just Google this issue and of the hundreds of BRTs throughout the world moving millions of people. There's a heck of a track record for its efficiency, for its safety.
Aren't they all larger communities, though? I mean, I hear about the BRT in Cleveland, and people say, hey, Cleveland is Cleveland. East Lansing is another matter entirely.
Well, you don't have to look all that far to find one that's in a similar size. Look at Eugene, Oregon. Once you do out the population numbers of the communities that it serves and the communities that the BRT in the capital area would serve, it's within a couple thousand, really 250,000, right around that mark for a total population served. And there you're seeing massive growth along the BRT corridor that economic studies have shown would not have occurred otherwise. Within the half mile along their BRT service, you're seeing a mass increase in rents, a big increase in development. And it's not just the, you know, arts and entertainment sector. Those are actually being pushed a little bit further off the main corridor because there's so many people who want office space and management type firms right along the corridor, because that's what millennials are wanting. They want to see these cities that are walkable and easily transit options for them to get from one end to the other.
Well, we'll move Bob Swanson and Joe Ross back into this thing, though. Isn't it true that the project would also reduce the green median space that pedestrians use in downtown East Lansing? You're laughing. That's not true. That's in circulation.
I've heard that. But when somebody is nitpicking over an area that's got a four-lane busy road, I mean, green space, does anybody get up in the morning and really think, oh, I really want to go visit that green space on Grand River?
But aesthetically, it adds a lot to Grand River Avenue, doesn't it?
But you know what? This is, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is so much bigger than some trees and about 20 feet of a grass median. I mean, this BRT, as a business guy, what I see is not just me today. I see this as an economic engine for the future. This corridor, what it really needs is density, population density. And the seven millennials that work for me, they don't drive cars. They want a BRT. Another thing is, to get that density, you need new businesses and new places to live on that corridor. And this BRT is our best shot at that.
Something is due on September 2nd. Help our listeners get a grasp on the timeline here, Bob Swanson. What is happening on September 2nd? Why is it important?
On September 2nd, we're going to be applying for what's called a Small Starts grant from the federal government for the BRT. The importance of that is that meeting that application deadline gets us in line to be included in the president's budget for fiscal year 2018. Get to the right century here, but yeah, 2018. And that's important for the project to move forward. We believe that over the next 2 years, we'll get the answers to this, the design will be completed, and we'll be able to move forward with actual construction in that budget year. But to get into that budget year, we have to meet that September 2nd deadline. It doesn't mean that everything is fixed in stone at that point. There's ample time to make changes to it as we go forward.
So you expect that application to make the deadline?
Yeah, we will
keep the thing
alive.
We will meet that
deadline. We are also in the process of determining what additional options we're going to try and review based on the meetings we had with Meridian Township last week, based on the meetings with the disability community, other input we've received, and there may well be changes, and there's certainly room for changes beyond that.
Are there public meetings scheduled?
There will be, not at this
point.
There aren't any at this point.
Now.
But we will have a public hearing on what's called the environmental assessment at the time that's completed. And that is a very key date in terms of what the plans will end up being.
We want to thank our three guests. Bob Swanson is the vice chair of the CATA Board of Directors. Sean Hammond is the founder of the grassroots organization CATS, Capital Area Transit Supporters. He's also deputy policy director at the Michigan Environmental Council. And Joe Ross is an East Lansing business owner who supports the BRT. We'll maybe have you back. We thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency is working with employers and other organizations, including some that often compete with each other, to help veterans find jobs in Michigan. We'll talk with Dave Dunkel, an employment analyst with the MVAA, about the Why Michigan Talent Attraction Team coming up on Current State. This is Current State on 90.5 WKAR. There's something fascinating about a shipwreck. When one's discovered, it's like a window into the past. All the more exciting because it's been hidden in deep water for so long. The latest shipwreck discovered in the Great Lakes was announced just a few days ago. It was found off the coast of Oswego, New York, in about 500 feet of water. Known as the Lady Washington, it's believed to be the oldest commercial vessel ever to sail on the Great Lakes. Joining us by phone, Jim Kennard, who led the discovery team who found the shipwreck. Jim, welcome.
Good morning.
Also joining us by phone, Executive Director of the National Museum of the Great Lakes, Chris Gilchrist. Chris, welcome to Current State.
Thanks so much for having us.
Chris, this is the oldest commercial vessel found in the Great Lakes. How old are we talking about here?
Well, she was built around 1797 and sank in 1803, so we've pushed the 200-year mark on birth points, which is really an extraordinary discovery and find.
What were the circumstances of its demise here exactly?
Well, I defer to Jim, who is the researcher and discoverer on that, because he really in order to identify the boat, he knows the history more than anybody else.
Jim, what happened?
Well, I should correct the name. The name is the sloop Washington, and there is a little bit of confusion here because when the ship was sold to the Pennsylvania Population Company, there were two names that were suggested. One was Washington, the other was Lady Washington. The largest share owner, Robert Hamilton, from Queenston, Ontario, he selected the name Washington. However, the other name, Lady Washington, kind of stuck, and some kept calling it that. But what was being recorded both in the lighthouse records and customs records is the sloop Washington. The Washington was built near Lake Erie and transported around Niagara Falls over a portage road at that time. So it went up over land and traveled 8 miles on land, and not by sail, but by skids and rollers. And then the Pennsylvania Population Company actually sold it to a group of merchants in Queenston. So from about 1802 to 1803, it was sailing on Lake Ontario, And what it was doing, it was carrying furs because the fur trade was big at that time, and they were transporting furs from the Queenston, Niagara area to Kingston and on to Montreal and then to the UK. Then on the return, it was taking it was bringing back more general merchandise like flour and salt and household type items from Kingston. And I believe they were also going to Oswego, which is kind of across the almost directly across the lake on the New York side, and then back to Niagara. So they left Kingston on November 6th, which is, you know, it's not a good time to be out on a lake in you know, the gales in November, and
yeah.
We all know that song. And so it was coming back, and I suspect they were trying to make Oswego, because this is where we found the ship, you know, off of Oswego. And they got caught in a gale, and, you know, unfortunately they didn't make it, and the ship went down.
It's a morbid question, but were there casualties here? Were people rescued,
what
do we know?
There were no survivors.
Okay. Chris, from your perspective, what's the historical significance of this discovery?
Well, I think if we look at it in the specific, each shipwreck tells a great story about what cargo it was carrying, perhaps even early ship design and naval architecture, the experience of the crew, how it was crewed, the fact that sloops were fairly rare on the Great Lakes at that time and pushing into the 19th century. But on a bigger picture, shipwrecks build enthusiasm for the topic of maritime history. We like to say that the Great Lakes holds 84% of the North American continent's fresh water, and there's a different story in every drop. Mm. And Jim Kinnard and his great crew are finding these drops, and they're big drops. The Washington is a big drop of water, which encourages people to say, oh, I didn't realize there's more about those things called the Great Lakes than I ever imagined. And that's really the great value, I think, to the general public, besides the very specific information about this particular wreck.
Chris Gilchrist is executive director of the National Museum of the Great Lakes. Jim Kinnard led the discovery team who found the Washington in about 500 feet of water. The announcement of its discovery was just announced last week. The Washington is believed to be the first commercial, the oldest commercial vessel ever to sail on the Great Lakes. Jim, you discovered the ship using side scanning sonar. For our lay listeners who don't know much about sonar and shipwrecks, can you walk us through how that works?
Yeah, well, I think if your listeners are familiar with ultrasound, which is the doctor uses it to look in, especially into a woman's womb, to look at the baby, so you see actually a picture of what the outline of the picture of a baby. Well, the side scan sonar is just like that, but it's just like on a bigger scale, and a image is created underwater by use of sound. And it's not just what's under the boat, but it's off to either side. And so the picture that's being presented to us now on a computer screen is kind of a waterfall display as we're moving along. The sonar picture of the bottom appears. It looks like an aerial photograph of the bottom, so that anything down there is going to show up. It's going to rocks or trees, sand waves, and, of course, a shipwreck, and even sometimes an airplane. And it does look just like what you would expect almost to see if you took the water away and shot an aerial photograph. And so this is how we look for these shipwrecks. And it depends on the way you set the range up, but typically we're looking out about somewhere around 1,200 foot wide area. So, and what we do is we sort of mow the lawn and go back and forth on longitude or latitude lines.
Okay.
and essentially mow the lawn and see what's there. Most of the time, there's nothing there, but once in a while, you get lucky.
Yeah, and you used, I know you used a remotely operated vehicle to descend
yes.
to the wreck. Did anyone dive down to the shipwreck
no,
itself?
No, the shipwrecks, most of them out in Lake Ontario, are way too deep for recreational divers, so we use a remote-operated vehicle with multiple cameras on board, and we had a black and white, plus we had an HD camera on board as well. So if your listeners would like to see a video of it, you can go to our website, www.shipwreckworld, that's all one word, shipwreckworld.com, and you'll see a nice video. It's been playing on YouTube, and it's nearing almost 100,000 views, so I'm just amazed.
I'm surprised by the condition of the ship. It would appear to be in better shape than I would have expected it to be.
Yeah, you know, in the thing about ships in the Great Lakes and in fresh water is they don't disintegrate like they do in salt water. It's not because of the salt water. It's because in salt water there's a mollusk called a teredo worm, burrows holes in the wood, and after a while the ship just kind of falls apart. That mollusk doesn't exist in the Great Lakes. So if you are if the ship is in deep water where there's low oxygen content and there's no wave action, the ship is going to remain, going to deteriorate very, very slowly. The only problem we have now is the invasive species of the quagga mussel. They do attach themselves to the ship, and after a while they sort of clump up because they invite their friends, and then they all fall off, and they those clumps fall off, and they rip little pieces of the wreck. But that's a very, very slow process, and those ships definitely we're very lucky that those old ships do survive, because as Chris pointed out, we can get a lot of information from the pictures and of what those ships look like, because there were no drawings or half hull models way back then. So
and the Great Lakes are shark free to boot, which is a nice advantage.
That's a good thing.
As well, Chris, put a little bit more perspective into this from your point of view. How many ships have been wrecked in Lake Ontario, and how many have yet to be found? Do you know?
I think that's my better question.
Yeah, I think
answer.
Jim can do justice, because he's been on Lake Ontario for, I don't know, 40 years, Jim.
Now you're putting numbers to my age. To give you a perspective, in the Great Lakes, there's been about 6,000 to 8,000 ships that have wrecked, but they're not all there. In Lake Ontario, about somewhere over 600 have wrecked, but most of them wrecked on shore, wrecked at the pier, some burned, some sank and were retrieved and put back into service. So my database says we've got about 200 ships out in Lake Ontario that still exist, and that's in an area of Lake Ontario that's 7,540 square miles. So that puts a ship maybe every 37 square miles there might be a shipwreck. But we have to be very selective where we go, because you just don't go out and just search anywhere. Based on the information that I've dug up about these ships, we select areas where the potential is where we're going to find something. And because otherwise, you could waste an awful lot of time, an awful lot of money. And we don't get that many days we can actually get out and search. We're lucky maybe 15 or 20 times in a season. Last year, we were down to 15, and sometimes we get blown off the lake.
I'm speaking with Jim Kennard, who led the discovery team that just recently discovered the Washington. We're also talking with Executive Director of the National Museum of the Great Lakes, Chris Gilchrist, down in Toledo. Chris, do you ever go out on any of these expeditions?
I'm actually the only executive director of a maritime museum who can't stand being on water because I get seasick, terrible seasickness. So I don't believe in micromanaging staff or volunteers or collaborators. So I just let Jim and his crew do the good work they're doing. something. And I await the phone call that says, we think we found something, which is a great, great exhilarating experience.
What is the most, is there a wreck that we know about in the Great Lakes? And I'll direct this to either of you. Jim, well, I'll come to you first. Is there a wreck in the Great Lakes that you would like to know that is substantiated, that we know is out there, that is high on your list or tops on your list of wrecks that you'd like to discover?
Well, let me put it this way. The one that was on my list for over 30-some-odd years was HMS Ontario, the British warship. That would have been the Holy Grail, or one of the Holy Grails of the Great Lakes. We were fortunate to have found that in 2008. The Washington was the second. So that was the second one that was on our list. So
you need a new number. You need a new number one then. What's yeah. next?
I think the one that people are still wondering about is the ship called the Griffin.
Now, yes.
That was, 1679 when it went down, but it's been found by 22 different people in 22 different places and in two different lakes. So, the question is, does it still exist? Is it still out there? I think that's the mystery that still remains, and it may remain forever. Who knows?
We've got just 30 seconds. Whichever of you is more qualified to answer here, what happens now with the Washington? Will divers go down to study it, or will it be surfaced or just left alone? What?
No, the Washington is too deep. There's probably no reason to go back anymore. I think we have the measurements. We have the pictures. Unless there was some artifact retrieval requested by the state of New York, it will remain there forever.
Jim Kennard led the discovery team that just recently discovered the Washington in Lake Ontario. It went down in 1803. We also want to thank our other guest. Chris Gilchrist is executive director of the National Museum of the Great Lakes, which sounds like a place worth a visit in Toledo, Ohio. Jim and Chris, thank you for joining us on Current State.
Thank you so much.
Morning.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. One of the aims of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, the MVAA, is to improve the employment climate for Michigan veterans. The agency's recently launched Why Michigan, the Why Michigan Talent Attraction Team. It works to connect with veterans just as they're leaving military service to explore work opportunities in the state. Two guests involved in that effort join me today. David Dunkel is Senior Strategy Analyst for Employment for the MVAA. He's also temporarily involved in other MVAA services like education, healthcare, and quality of life. David, welcome.
Hi, Mark.
And we're also joined on the phone today by Justin Mendoza, a team leader with the Quicken Loans Veteran Hiring Program. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Mark. Thanks for having us.
Sure. Dave, where did the idea for this talent attraction team come from?
It was kind of a collaborative effort, Mark. We sat with people from the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, and we were talking about how to attract more veteran talent back to Michigan. And instead of taking a passive role, we decided to take an active role and go to where service members are transitioning and speak to them directly.
This is part of another MVAA program, the Veteran-Friendly Certification Program. What is that?
The Veteran-Friendly Certification Program is a process where we look at local and state employers and we certify them as being veteran-friendly. They make a commitment to hire veterans and create a veteran-friendly environment, and we help them do that.
Your plan is to connect with these veterans at what are called active duty transition points. What are those?
Active duty transition points are spread actually all around the world, and those are locations where service members transition from the military to civilian life.
Okay. And I know the program is fairly recent. Has your work started? How much of this work have you done so far?
We've actually done quite a bit. We're in the planning stages for a visit to Fort Carson, Colorado right now, but we recently visited the Service Academy Career Conference in Washington, D.C., and it was a combined effort between state agencies and private sector employers. And we travel together. We create an entire Pure Michigan experience for job seekers out there.
Justin Mendoza of Quicken Loans, let's come to you. Tell us about Quicken's involvement with these MVAA programs, please.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Dave was saying, it's a very important partnership that we have, that we're able to create this collaborative effort, this synergy of among private partnership and public to share those best practices and lessons learned to do what we're trying to do and attract that veteran talent to come to Michigan. And it's been a great program so far, a lot of support, and we're excited to be joining them out in Fort Carson, Colorado, for the Why Michigan campaign.
And I understand Quicken is a gold-level employer here in terms of their state certification, right? So David Dunkel, they obviously take it pretty seriously down there.
They certainly do. I mean, Justin and I have worked together the past few years, actually, in different roles. There's very few of us out there in the veteran hiring community. And Quicken rose pretty quickly through the ranks because of their robust outreach programs and their veteran hiring initiatives.
Justin, I know these discussions don't just center on employment opportunities, but they sometimes, as David pointed out, it's kind of a Pure Michigan kind of vibe that sometimes unfolds here. It's about a broader quality of life. How do you work at Quicken, how do you work those priorities into this process?
I believe they all tie together. When we're out there in the community, like Dave was saying, we go out to the community, we're going to those transition points, we're going on basis, we're talking to these service members that either may or may not know about the opportunities that are in Michigan. And so not only are we talking to them about what the opportunities are at Quicken Loans, where they're making that career transition, but also what's happening in Detroit, Michigan, as well as the opportunities here in Michigan, because there are a lot of them. And when we're targeting that population is used to moving. They're open to relocation or coming home. So that's why it's good to have that conversation and have that collaborative effort.
Broadly, David, what recommends a veteran? Are they an underutilized? I would expect you to say they may well be an underutilized group in terms of satisfying a Michigan employer or an employer anywhere. Is that the case?
That's absolutely true. There's 275,000 to 300,000 transitioning service members each year, and they bring a unique skill set to employers.
They have to.
Yes, they are. They're loyal. They're team-oriented. They're used to working in austere environments with very little guidance and very little equipment. They're problem solvers. A lot of the morals that employers try hard to instill in their employees over years,
veterans already have.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would think they would. How many veterans does Quicken employ, Justin?
Currently, we have over 500 veterans.
Wow.
Team members.
My gosh, that sounds like a lot. Dave, we're giving Quicken Loans credit here for working with the program. I know there are others, though. Who are some of those others?
Certainly. You know, joining Quicken Loans as gold-level employers, we have GM, we have Whirlpool, and Roush Industries down in Livonia, Michigan. All of them work side by side with each other, even though sometimes they're in direct competition for the workforce. It's amazing to see the collaborative efforts that come out of our group meetings where we remove organizational obstacles to veteran success here in the state.
Justin, I know Quicken is a part of this movement here. Are you referring veterans to other companies, or are you taking referrals from other companies?
Yeah, absolutely. It's that collective genius, that community that we get to work with and share those best practices. So if someone has a better opportunity at another company, maybe having that conversation will point them in that right direction and vice versa.
We're talking with Justin Mendoza of Quicken Loans about the new Why Michigan talent team, working to make Michigan a place where veterans will want to work and where employers are looking to hire them. We're also talking with David Dunkel of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Do you have a lot more outreach to do in terms of connecting with companies about this program, David, or do you think most of them have heard about it by now?
Well, we absolutely do. Right now, we have almost 75 pretty good-sized companies that have signed on to the program, but when you look at the number of employers in the state of Michigan, that's actually a drop in the bucket. So
venue... You've gone to the biggest ones first, though, so you could make...
They've actually come to us. come to us. Workforce development is a challenge that every Michigan employer faces. Finding quality employees is sometimes a difficult task, and we are a valuable resource to the private sector employers out there that are looking for talent.
America's fighting forces in Iraq and Afghanistan have gone down in recent years to relatively few. Are David and Justin, for that matter, are you working with more veterans with fewer challenges returning to civilian life?
Why don't you go ahead and take that, Justin?
Well, there's a lot of opportunity out there, and there are those unique challenges, and I think that's why this program exists, to help bridge that gap. Between that military service and those private and public hiring agencies. When we're talking about 1% of the population that serves, it's the other 99% that doesn't, and we want to bridge that gap. And that's why we exist, and that's why we get to do what we do on a daily basis.
Dave, what other state agencies are you working with here, and what roles do they have?
We work with the Michigan Economic Development Corporation, who helps employers build overall strategic plans when it comes to business development in the state. We also work with the Workforce Development Agency. Our great friends at the Michigan Works offices, the 16 regional locations that act in a role similar to the old unemployment offices. The Michigan Department of Transportation, one of our premier silver-level employers, soon to be gold. The Michigan Civil Service Commission. It's a real collaborative effort between all sorts of state and federal agencies to get this job done.
With 500 veterans working at Quicken Loans, Justin, do these veterans find each other out? Is there kind of a little subculture of people with military experience that's emerging at Quicken?
Yeah, absolutely. We have different outreach efforts that we have for them, different programs to tie them together and have that camaraderie that we set for them, through the year, whether it's, going to a exclusive service football game or, getting together to have lunch with your fellow veterans. We do different things of that nature.
Is there awareness amongst the other Quicken employees of situations like PTSD amongst your veteran workforce? Is there an awareness there?
Yeah, we actually have a great team with our team relations that are part of our HR department that helps, spread that awareness to make sure that we're getting rid of, that stigma. Again, going back to that, you don't know what you don't know, and that larger population, we have those tools out there for our leaders that are leading these veteran team members.
Dave, there's another group involved in this effort, the Private Sector Veteran Employment Council. It sounds as if these teams and councils have names that you've got a number of people working in the same direction, working together here.
Exactly. And the Private Sector Veteran Employment Council works under the auspices of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. And it's a partnership between private sector employers and state agencies. We meet quarterly. Like I say, we remove organizational obstacles to veteran success in the state. We formulate best practices. But the best part of it is we trade those best practices with like-minded employers and with employers who are just stumbling upon the value of hiring a veteran. We do that by having veteran hiring best practices workshops that are sponsored. Matter of fact, Quicken Loans is sponsoring our next one in October at their headquarters, and they open their doors to local employers who are interested in hiring veterans and trade those best practices that they've worked really hard to formulate themselves.
Are there goals for your programs? I mean, in terms of numbers, how will you measure the success of this effort?
Well, we've told Governor Snyder that we plan on putting 3,000 veterans to work this fiscal year, and we will make that goal. I get up every
morning. The year we're in now. This
correct.
Is by October 1st.
Okay. Correct.
Okay.
And I get up every morning, and if there's an unemployed veteran in the state, that becomes my goal, even if it's a single unemployed veteran. We've made great progress. In the last 3 years, we've lowered the veteran unemployment rate by double digits. There is still some disparity in the unemployment rate between the younger veterans, those 20 to 28-year-old veterans are still slightly underemployed, and so we tend to focus on that group and see if we can develop solutions to address their specific needs.
We've been talking with David Dunkel of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Also, thanks to Justin Mendoza of Quicken Loans about the state efforts to appeal to veterans looking for work in Michigan. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, National Geographic magazine is featuring the work of a young Detroit photographer in the August issue. Marissa Gowell focuses on the charm of American roadside attractions. Love that. Scott Pohl talks with her about the project. Plus, he took second place on the NBC reality show Last Comic Standing. This week he's making four stops in Michigan. Share a laugh with stand-up comedian Ralphie May. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and Drew Hill. The Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with us on Twitter. Follow us at KAR Current State. On Facebook, find us at Current State from WKAR. We're glad you could join us today. We hope you can do it again tomorrow. It's Current State on WKAR.